best of us lyricists is that he is a poet. Oscar Hammerstein's great musical legacy reaches back three generations, beginning with his immigrant grandfather, who helped create the Times Square Theater District in New York. Oscar Hammerstein's grandson has written a history of his family's influence on American musical theater. Pardon me, it's titled The Hammersteins, and Oscar Andy Hammerstein joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll hear music, we'll have phone calls, we'll have tweets and messages on Facebook. Good morning to you, Andy.
And a snowy good morning to you too, Diane.
It's good to see you. And tell us first your place in the Hammerstein line.
Of course. My grandfather was the lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. And his grandfather was Oscar Hammerstein I. And in between the two Oscar Hammersteins, there were some sons who also worked in the business. William Hammerstein, who ran a vaudeville house, and Arthur Hammerstein, who produced operettas.
Tell me about your family's work in the theater district long before you were born.
Okay. Well, my great-great-grandfather, Oscar Hammerstein I, who was never called Oscar Hammerstein I when he was alive, but we call him the first to not be confusing. He started building theaters up in Harlem. The original Apollo Theater was his. And he also started building theaters in the 34th Street District as well. But I suppose he's best known for spearheading the development of Times Square as a theater district by building the Olympia Theater in 1895, which was really a three-theater complex that sat 6,000 people. It was his hope back then that he could corner the market on Broadway theater in Times Square. He misjudged that wildly and was out of business, but not down for the count. Anyway, he went on to build more theaters in the same area. He built the Republic Theater and the Victoria Theater and the Lou Fields Theater. And he did all this right at the turn of the century before building in 1906 the Manhattan Opera House back on 34th Street, which is still stands, and it's known as the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City.
He was an immigrant. Why was this so much in his blood?
That's a very good question. There's speculation, and the speculation is as a good German Jew in the 1880s who was assimilated into his culture in Germany and who thought of himself as a German first and a Jew second, I think that opera served as a very, as a bridge, you might say, because opera is the sung story. It's the rabbi and the cantor. It's the it's a continuation if you are post-Judaic, and I think our family took that impetus. He brought that passion of opera loving to this country with him when he arrived at the age of 15.
So then your family's legacy, your grandfather's early years, what instruments did he play? What did he think about music? How did his father influence him?
Oscar II or Oscar I?
Oscar II.
Oh, well, with Oscar II played piano badly, and he was... The reason why he got into the theater, well, he always loved the theater. It would be hard not to love the theater if your uncle did operettas, your father did vaudeville, and your grandfather did opera. And his father didn't want him to go into the business. He wanted him to have a respectable trade because it had caused so much heartache watching Oscar I bankrupt the family over and over again. So he'd made Oscar promise not to go into the theater.
So he went to law school for a little while.
He did, to Columbia University, to study law at the request of his father, promising never to get involved in the theater, though he loved the theater and clearly was moonlighting in the varsity shows at Columbia. And when his father died in 1914, he soon after got married and wife got pregnant, and he needed a job besides clerking at a law firm, which didn't pay that much back then. So he went to his Uncle Arthur and said, listen, I really love the theater. I know I promised my father, but I really wanted to get a job. I'll be willing to start at the bottom and the worst job you can give me. So Arthur had to weigh the pros and cons of Oscar breaking his promise to his now deceased father. And he, you know, he understood that Willie Hammerstein had suffered greatly under his own father, Oscar the First, but Arthur had a wonderful career as an operetta producer, and he said, go ahead, I'll give you a job as second assistant stage manager on a show called You're in Love in 1919, and that's how it began.
Oscar Andrew Hammerstein, he's a painter, writer, lecturer, and adjunct professor at Columbia University. He has written about an extraordinary musical theater family, the Hammersteins. If you'd like to join us, the phones are open, 800-433-8850, and you can join us by email, Facebook, or Twitter. Tell us about Showboat and why it made such a huge splash when it opened.
Well, first of all, it was a tonic, you might say, for what had been both complacent and redundant fairy tale operettas of the 20s. In the old days, a show was really just an excuse to put on talent. And the idea of an integrated plot or a narrative that really undergirded the show was kind of laughable. I mean, you'd have plots, but if you didn't follow the plot, it didn't really matter throughout the 20s. And Showboat broke with that on a number of levels. First of all, Oscar and Jerry Curran had a year to work on the show, and both of them were very interested in the integrated musical for their time. It is something of a it's different because it is not just a melodrama, but it also has elements of realism. It's a bit of a hybrid, and it talks not only about miscegenation in the post-Civil War South, but also it's a musing upon fate itself. For some deserve their happy ever endings, and others don't. It's quite realistic for the time.
And in it, we have what has been called the first protest song on Broadway.
What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Old Man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along.
The wonderful thing about this song is that Oscar disappears inside the lyric. You don't get a feeling of the author. You get a feeling of Joe singing this song. He writes for a man who's not educated, who's speaking from his heart. In some ways, this is the beauty of Oscar. He is letting the character do the talking, and the more you let that character do the talking, the more you subsume your own voice. To that extent, I think Oscar II was an artist.
Tote that barge, lift that veil, get a little drunk, and your land's in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But old man River, just keep rolling along. Let me go away from the Mississippi. Let me go
away. And of course, that is the gorgeous voice of Paul Robeson singing that. Your grandfather was undergoing a rather stormy personal life at that time.
Oh, yes, he was. Well, he was in a difficult marriage that had some fooling around going on part of his wife. And I think at that time he went traveling by boat, and that's where he met his second wife, my grandmother, Dorothy Hammerstein. And so the area around Showboat marks a giant transitional time for Oscar Hammerstein II. He falls in love across a crowded room, as it were, and he writes what may be the most influential musical of musical theater history. Some may argue Oklahoma, it marks the high point in the first half of his career. He has moved from Rosemarie through a number of operetta songs up to Showboat, and then the 30s come.
But tell me about that agonizing divorce from Myra.
Well, Oscar was a workaholic, and the marriage was never an easy fit to begin with. It turned out that Myra was having an affair, and probably not the only one, but she was having an affair with the writer Guy Bolton. And when that occurred, Oscar II at first tried to ignore it, then he tried... Then he had a nervous breakdown, and he had to recover from that.
Oscar Andrew Hammerstein. We're talking about his new book, The Hammersteins, A Musical Theater Family.
We sweat and strain, body all eaten and wrecked with pain, tote that barge.
More Diane Reem Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon, I'm Elliot Francis.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm Communications Director Kay Summers.
Domestic pets can help people take their minds off their loneliness, grief, and pain, but many people who want the companionship can't own a pet.
Area organizations are working to provide pet visits to hospitals, schools, and nursing homes.
In the district, People Animals Love helps by coordinating volunteers and their pets to visit schools, nursing homes, hospitals, and mental health facilities.
Fairfax Pets on Wheels does the same by bringing together animals and Fairfax County residents who live in nursing homes and assisted living facilities.
Both organizations conduct training programs for new volunteers and pets.
More information is at WAMU.org. Click on Community.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private nonprofit corporation funded by the American people to help support diverse and innovative non-commercial programming.
This program of the Diane Reem Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls, but we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling, everything's going my way.
Now, Andy, this song and this play really changed how everything worked on Broadway. Tell us how.
From the first note. The one thing that would have preceded this, in shows that preceded this, would have been a high-kicking chorus number where everyone would have a chance to get to their seats if they were late, something like that. It was a throwaway number, something to say, we're full of energy, we're full of life, you're going to have a good time. This, markedly different. This show starts on the first note. The first song comes out, and it's telling the people, get to your seats. We're telling a story here, and we're telling it, and we, the authors, are taking it seriously, so you had better take it seriously too. And that cued the audience to sit down and shut up, because this was a serious endeavor.
The sounds of the earth are like music. All the sounds of the earth are like music. The breeze is so busy, it don't miss a tree. And old weeping willow is laughing at me. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way. Oh, what a beautiful day.
And that from the 1955 motion picture soundtrack, sung by Gordon McRae. You know, Andy, there was this sense that both his partnership with Rogers and his own work moved away from sort of comic sentiment, entertainment, pure entertainment, into the social issues.
Yes. Yes, it did. Well, there are two actual answers to that setup. The first one is that he didn't do musical comedy. He did musical plays. There'll be laughs in a musical play, but it's not a comedy. It's not about legs and laughs. It's about love and death, very much the way operas are. Now, that's an important distinction, because love and death are serious business. And his shows, no matter how whimsical they might be at times, are serious business. His best shows are the shows where he deals with these things: Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific King and I, and to some extent Sound of Music.
My boy Bill, I will see that he's named after me. I will. My boy Bill, he'll be tall and as tough as a tree. Will Bill, like a tree, he'll grow with his head held high and his feet planted firm on the ground. And you won't see nobody dare to try to boss him or toss him around. No pot-bellied, baggy-eyed bully'll boss him around. I don't give
Why
a darn
is
what he does.
This song so important, Andy?
Well, this is the song story. Now, Stephen Sondheim says there are three things that Oscar Hammerstein left in his wake, and this is probably the most important one. The first two is the delayed love song, the duet between the major leads in the first act. If I Loved You, People Will Say We're in Love, Make Believe, even Surrey with the Fringe on Top in some ways, are all songs that allow us to develop character before they throw the two lovers together. The second convention is starting your show right off the bat with Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. That cues the audience you're taking yourself seriously. But this song, this 8-minute tour de force, compresses an entire first act into a single song, and it is so distinctive and so different from the normal popular song, because it develops character, and it also takes the plot around corners. Here you have a man, an anti-hero who's not all that likable the more you listen to him, going on about what it would be like to have a boy, and we don't know much about the boy, but we start to learn a lot about him and all the experiences that he has had. Then he realizes that the boy might be a girl, and he has a whiplash moment, and all of a sudden he's realizing he's got to do anything it takes to save this girl from, you know, boys like himself. And the next thing you know, this plot has gone around every corner and developed so much character that it drops you off in a completely different place than where you first started.
Say, why am I taking on like this?
My kid ain't even been born yet. I can see him when he's 17 or so.
and starting in to go with a girl. I can give him lots of pointers, very sound, on the way to get round any girl. I can tell him,
wait a minute, could it be? What the hell? What if he is a girl? A girl?
I wish there were a camera in here watching you mouth and move.
I do love
these
this song.
Words.
I do love this song. I think this is the essence of musical theater. This is the sung story. This, if you didn't see the, if you came into the second act of this show and all you'd had was this song, you'd know what had happened. You know that this is not going to be a love song because you know this man is doomed. This man will be dead by the end of the first act.
But, of course, there are other works that come. South Pacific, The King and I. The South Pacific opened on Broadway 1949, ran for over 5 years.
Yes.
Extraordinary.
It was an extraordinary show. It's still a marvelous show to watch. It's as alive today, and it resonates with today's audiences. I think anytime we have a military that we are concerned about, this show takes on the resonance that it originally had.
Got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8. To hate all the people your relatives hate, you've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
This song is as relevant today as it was 50 years ago.
And maybe more so. In some ways, Oscar got a lot of flack for this song. They said he was being preachy. And I remember the story goes that he took the song to James Michener and said, James, you know, he wrote Tales of the South Pacific, from which this was adapted. And he said, people are telling me I should get this, take the song out. What do you think? And he said, by all means, do not. This is the core of the show. Without this song, there is no show. And I think that James Michener was quite correct. I don't think Oscar would have taken the song out anyway, but I'm glad to have the story about
courteous.
That.
He was being courteous.
And Oscar had a deep humanitarian, civil libertarian streak that has gone through his entire life that crops up here and there, crops up big time in Showboat, crops up big time in South Pacific. And in his personal life, he was a liberal with a small L. Back in the 1940s and 1950s, when it was a tough go in J. Edgar Hoover's America. And he has a long FBI file to show for it, but he endorsed and championed the rights of individuals to speak and think the way they thought.
How did the FBI pursue him? To what extent were they interested in what he was saying and doing?
Phone, mail, and tagging him. He was easily tagged, trailed, mailed, phoned. He had no secrets because first of all, when Showboat came out, there were some states that still had miscegenation laws on the books, so they explicitly banned him from presenting Showboat or even for traveling through their states. Also, let's see, there were other reasons. Besides Showboat, there was also, let's see, what are the other ones? He was obviously a champion of civil liberties as well. I'm blanking on what I should be thinking here. But he was never afraid to confront intolerance. And I think that comes out of his theater upbringing. Because in the theater, everything is a meritocracy. You work with people who have talent, regardless of their gender or their anything, of their race or anything. If you can sell tickets, that's the world Oscar grew up in. And so he found it hard to swallow to see, you know, racism and other kinds of bias.
Well, and even in The Sound of Music, we're talking about the views of Austrians to take over Austria by the Third Reich. We're talking about domestic violence in Carousel.
Sure.
You're talking about racist views in South Pacific. But then we get to The King and I. Tell us about The King and I.
Well, the thing I love about King and I was there's a song in this show called A Puzzlement, which is what Oscar was critiquing, I suppose, was absolute power and absolute certainty. A song was all about the word but. And here is a king who's supposed to be chosen by God to rule subjects, and he's obsessing about but. It's a puzzlement. And how can you do that if you're an absolute ruler?
Oscar Andrew Hammerstein. We're talking about his new book titled The Hammersteins, A Musical Theater Family.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you, getting to like you, getting to hope you like me, getting to know you, putting it my way, but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy. When I am with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new.
Of course, that is the lovely Marnie Nixon dubbing for Deborah Carr in the motion picture from 1956, The King and I. How marvelous.
Yes. It brings to mind a certain how interesting the movie versions as opposed to the theater versions. And the best example that I think of is actually Carousel, to go backwards just a little bit. When Carousel was written in 1945, everyone had lost a brother, a father, a son in the war. So a story about a man trying to make amends from beyond the grave is a truly resonant story for the audiences of 1945. By the time it was made into a movie, it was like 1955. And while it was a popular movie, it didn't resonate with the American audience of 1955 in the same way, because now it was the conformist 50s, and it was as much about trying to get the wayward girl to fit into her group as it was about a story about a man trying to seek redemption from beyond the grave. So it's interesting when you listen to the musicals made that were the film versions of the musicals, how just a little change in time can often change the perception of the show. It's the same show, different audience.
But this show is timeless. This, The King and I, just continues to move audiences, either in film or on stage. The music just And Yul Brynner in that movie.
And one can't help also say that it has a great deal of its popularity has to do with the fact that it can cast a lot of children, and that the love relationship is relatively chaste by comparison to the other shows. So it's a big revival gem because of those reasons.
How old were you when you saw your first musical for which your grandfather had written the music?
Before I could logically answer that question, honestly.
How wonderful. Honestly,
there must have been a revival in 1959 that I must have been hearing through my tantrums, you know.
How marvelous. So they took you to theater.
Yes.
Quite early.
Well, also, my father was a director, so I was on the road a lot, watching rehearsals for a lot of shows. So I was kind of a backstager from the time I was a little baby.
Oscar Andrew Hammerstein. His new book is titled The Hammersteins, a Musical Theater Family.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, D.C. Public Schools at a Turning Point. We meet the district's interim schools chief, Kyer Henderson, plus the year in obituaries, from the titans of American foreign policy to one of the founding fathers of D.C.'s go-go music, remembering those who left us in 2010. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
I am assignment editor Memo Lyons.
And I'm reporter Jonathan Wilson.
Along with the rest of our WAMU 88.5 News colleagues, we've been doing our best to bring you the most important
and interesting
information from around our region.
Now it's time to take a little break.
Phew!
For something just as important, to wish you happy holidays on behalf of the entire news department.
So here's to wishing you a happy, safe, and warm holiday season.
Thanks for listening, and now, Memo,
it's back to work.
Partly sunny this afternoon, highs in the mid-30s. Tonight mostly clear, lows in the lower 20s. It's 36 degrees in southeast Washington at 2:38.
And I hope you're enjoying this program of conversation and music all about the Hammersteins, a musical theater family. The grandson of Oscar Hammerstein, who wrote the lyrics to most of our favorite Hollywood and Broadway productions, is with me, Oscar Andrew Hammerstein. Here's an email from Zachary, who says, Oscar was investigated by the FBI for his involvement in the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League and alleged communist activity in the 1930s. This led to his having to write a letter to the U.S. State Department in 1953 refuting the anti-American charges against him in order to renew his passport. How did these events affect his outlook on politics and issues of social justice?
Wow, that's a big question. First of all, he started the Anti-Nazi League in 1936 while he was out working for hire for the movies in Hollywood. And back then, this did not merit a page or two in his FBI file because everybody was anti-Nazi in 1936. It became retroactively stuck into his file in about 1943 when they were trying to hunt as much stuff down on him as they could. They did that because of a number of reasons that had to do with our feelings about Russia growing very cold after World War II. They were our allies, and when asked by investigators whether he would ever work with communists, Oscar said, I would be happy to work with communists if they loaded my gun to shoot fascists. And that sort of shut up the critics for a while. However, after a bit of time, they loaded up again and came after him, basically because he felt that the Hollywood Ten, which was a group of people who were accused of communist sympathies, some of whom had more sympathies than others, were all being lumped together and blacklisted out in Hollywood. And the same was true for a group of writers here in, on the East Coast as well. The point Oscar made was that he believed in his bones that a person ought not be punished for what he thought and what he said. And back in 1940s and the 1950s, that was a pretty tall order for people, especially with the witch hunts and the Red Scares, because back in those days, everybody thought there was a communist under every bed. So he basically said, I'm going to defend their right to think and feel the way they do. I don't agree with them, but I defend their right to think that way. When pressed, he said, I am not a communist, I'm a liberal. And he was very clear about that. A lot of people conflate the two, but they're not the same thing. He also said that he felt that they had every right to think the way they felt, and that he was going to defend their rights, and that he was up in J. Edgar Hoover's face defending, putting benefits together to for legal funds for the Hollywood Ten, basically for them to express their right to free speech in this country we live in.
Let's go now to Frisco, Texas. Good morning, Bernie. You're on the air.
Good morning. Once again, the Hammerstein family has made a good day for me. I have 2 points. The first is the marvelous epigram that I use in my classes. I'm 83 and still teach, and that comes from South Pacific. Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons. Wise men never try. I don't know where that came from out of a man's mind, but it is, to me, it is glorious. And the other thing is, I wonder how a big city boy knew about the Surrey with the fringe on top.
That's a good question. That's a very good question. First of all, I think the first quote comes from Some Enchanted Evening, and I guess it refers to love. Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons. Wise men never try. That is, if more people took that advice to heart, there would be a lot of less useless argument in the world. And what was the second one again?
Second one. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
What was the second one, Bernie?
How did a city boy?
Oh, that's it. Thank
fringe
you.
On top.
That's a good question. He always. It's funny about Oscar, because Oscar fancied himself the gentleman farmer, which is ironic because not only was he all thumbs as a human being, he couldn't even drive himself anywhere. He never got his driver's license. So he had this, I don't know, you might say, illusion about himself that wasn't borne out by fact. But he did move out to Bucks County, where he wrote a lot of his songs, and I think he sought a lot of solace from the country. For example, the show Allegro is all about the juxtaposition between country, simple country life and the fast pace of the city life. And he clearly romanticized, would be the best way to put, the simple characters that he put words, that he wrote words for in songs. He seemed to feel that simpler characters were easier to express their feelings, because their feelings were not moderated or modulated by doubt, that what you heard was what you got, you know?
Now, wasn't Surrey with the Fringe on Top one of his favorites, or
his favorite? It was his most favorite song, and you can understand it as he was asked why, and he said, well, the idea of two boneheaded young teenagers beginning to fall in love just makes him weep uncontrollably.
Oh, I love it. Thanks for calling, Bernie. Let's go to Greece, New York. Good morning.
Oh, hello.
Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. You've already talked a lot about this. I should have known that you would, but this is about this song, You've Got to Be Taught to Hate and Fear. I'm not sure if that's the title. Then from South Pacific, and I was going to ask, that was a controversial song for that day, but I was wondering, did they come up with the idea, Rodgers and Hammerstein, did they come up with the idea for it already to begin with, and I mean, at the same time or something, or whose idea was it first? And then I was just wondering, I mean, you mentioned that your grandfather was Jewish, and I wondered if maybe, you know, he'd experienced some anti-Semitism that always had been sort of the maybe the origin of his feelings to write the words for that song.
The song you're talking about is You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, and I don't actually have any stories about any sense of anti-Semitism that he experienced. He was a man who lived his entire life inside the walls of the theater, and inside the walls of the theater is a very different place where, as I said before, the meritocracy does not bias. There's no bias against being gay or being Jewish or being black or anything of those sorts. It's really about talent. So I think he had an understanding of intolerance. I don't think that it was specifically as a result of his being Jewish.
Oscar Andrew Hammerstein, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Newport, Rhode Island. Good morning, Steve. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My late mother was named Shirley Rich, and she was the casting director for South Pacific and The King and I, and she always was fond of telling the story. And I'm not sure how accurate it was, but this is the story I got growing up, that she was doing the casting for The King and I, and a strange-looking bald man walked out on stage, sat down cross-legged, and started playing an interesting musical instrument. And after about 30 seconds, I think your grandfather, Oscar, turned to my mother and said, "That's it, he's the one." I just thought you would find that interesting. She revered your grandfather.
That's, you have the story just about right. I'm going to read a small part from the book because it best describes who you're speaking about, which is Yul Brynner, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
Yul Brynner had perhaps the weirdest background in the history of theater. Born in Russia, schooled in China, and brought up by gypsies who taught him to play the seven-string guitar, he became an acrobat after a brief stint singing cabaret. Severe injuries curtailed his acrobatic career, and he became addicted to opium. He went to Switzerland for rehab, where he hung out with Jean Cocteau, Colette, and Marcel Marceau, and decided to study acting. He worked for, of all things, the U.S. Office of War Information as a foreign language radio broadcaster, and directed some television, including the justifiably acclaimed Omnibus, all before he answered the Rodgers and Hammerstein casting call. In fact, when they turned to each other and said, almost like Max Bialystock, "That's our king," they actually had in mind a kind of short, dumpy, unpleasant kind of a king. Huh. And when they got him, they got, okay, we can write for this. They were going to write for Gertrude Lawrence anyway, so they got a chance to write for the king as well. So it became not just a star vehicle for Gertrude Lawrence, but a breakout role for Yul Brynner, who ended up playing it for I can't count how many decades.
Here's an email from Bird, who says, "I understand the Ed Sullivan Theater in New York City, today the home of David Letterman's late night show, was originally the Hammerstein Opera House. Is that true?"
Close. It was the Hammerstein Theater. There was no real Hammerstein Opera House. There was a Manhattan Opera House down on 34th Street, but the Hammerstein Theater that he is talking about was built in 1927 and inaugurated by a show, what was the name of that show? Golden Dawn. And it was built by Oscar Hammerstein I's son, Arthur, who was Oscar II's uncle. And it was his hope to get into theater producing. Having been a producer, he wanted to also be a theater manager like his father, and like his father, could barely hold on to it for more than a few years. But yes.
And Peter goes on to say, "Why isn't Flower Drum Song ever performed? Wasn't that written while Rodgers and Hammerstein were at the top of their composing powers?"
Well, it wasn't at the top of their composing powers. They had actually suffered two flops just prior to it, Me and Juliet and then Pipe Dream. The thing about Flower Drum Song is it's a story about the conflict between generations, the immigrant experience, and the conflict between the generation that comes to this country and than the generation that grows up in this country. And the problem with those intergenerational conflicts is that they're topical and they have an expiration date. Those kind of shows, they fall out of favor because the storyline becomes dated.
And didn't your late father produce Flower Drum song?
My late father did direct it on the road, and he produced it later on, yes.
There is The Sound of Music, which for many of us remains that Christmas classic, that New Year's classic. Your grandfather died before the musical movie came out, but oh my.
With songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze, to laugh like a brook when it trips and falls over stones on its way, to sing through the night like a lark who is learning to pray.
How I hate interrupting Julie Andrews, or speaking over her. She's been a guest on this program numerous times. What a voice. What a musical.
I agree. I actually do agree. People have accused it of being a little saccharine. I'll have none of that. I think it's a wonderful show. I think it has all the depths of the other shows. And in this case, Oscar and Dick didn't write the libretto like they had in previous times. They just wrote the music. But I think the music adds so much to the show. It originally was supposed to be a play with incidental music written by Lindsay and Krauss. But Mary Martin, who believed Oscar and Dick to be her lucky charm, thought that it would deserve a little of the Rodgers and Hammerstein treatment. And Oscar and Dick said, we're not just going to put incidental music. If you want us to write, we're going to write into this and make it a musical. And she went, by all means. So they did. The sad part about the fact that Oscar never really got a chance to see Julie Andrews in this. He did get a chance to see her in Cinderella, and it is my contention that Julie Andrews was the perfect woman to play Rodgers and Hammerstein's musicals. It's ironic that she came on the scene so much later than their golden age.
And then those children at the end of that movie. Of course, that's Bill Lee's voice dubbed in for Christopher Plummer. Another one of those Hollywood secrets. Oh, Andy, I have so enjoyed talking with you.
The pleasure's been all mine. Thank you.
We should go for at least another 2 hours on all these beautiful songs.
Name the day.
Oscar Andrew Hammerstein. His new book is titled The Hammersteins, A Musical Theater Family. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reed.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.
And again, I would try to say all I'd want you to.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in Iran asking, why are we staying up all night?
In the old time, they would worry the sun would not reappear.
This is
Lakshmi Bhatmanglij.
She's invited me to her Georgetown kitchen to teach me about the Winter Solstice Festival.
Hello, Rachel.
Hello,
Lakshmi.
Orange blossom tea steams from a samovar. Food covers her table.
We have melon and watermelon, apple, persimmon, orange, and pomegranates and grapes. And I'm displaying the ceremonies for the winter festival, which they call Shabe Yalda.
It's held on the longest night of the year.
Shabe Yalda literally means the eve of birthday. In this case, refers to the sun's birthday.
The ceremony dates back to 600 BC.
It's a pre-Islamic rituals based on dualistic concept of good and evil, light and darkness, hot and cold.
Beside the fruit, Najmiya has roasted pistachios and almonds, dried mulberries, apricots and figs, white rice cookies, carrot halva, baklava, and pumpkin seeds.
They call this shabchare, means night grazing.
Grazing, that is, all night long. The eldest blesses the table and cuts the melon, then gives everyone a piece.
The act of cutting symbolizes the removal of any pain or trouble from the family.
Every ritual from this night has meaning, she says. Many are recounted in New Food of Life, one of her many cookbooks. Throughout the night, the family tells stories. Children learn about their ancestors.
They can stay up and they can ask questions. Whatever they want from their family, because every family there is a they have a mystery.
Najmiya says she sees connections.